When we set the date for a talk on the seven deadly sins, I was surprised when I began to think, this is the week after Easter. This seems like a rather odd time to be doing the seven deadly sins. We should have done it the week before Easter. But the more I've thought about it, the more I've realized this is really actually a very good time to be talking about these things. There's a verse from Colossians that has been sitting on my computer as I've been pondering the talks, and it's this. Through the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, the Father has delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. The seven deadly sins are what compose the domain of darkness. And we have been transferred from that domain into this kingdom of light. But one of the losses, particularly in the evangelical Protestant tradition in the last, several hundred years, has been the loss of understanding of the nature of sin. We gloss over it. We think about sin in generic, but not in specific. And here's the problem. If you don't understand your sin specifically, you can't repent of it. You're trapped in it. So what I want to do this week is to paint pictures for you of these various sins with their various specific signatures. All of them are unique in one way or the other. The seven deadly sins are not the sins that will send you to hell. The seven deadly sins are the core sins. They're the sins that all other sin flow from. And I want to help us understand the signatures of these sins by painting the particular decor of each prison that they keep us in. Each one has its unique features, but they also have some commonalities, and here is what they are. Every one of these sins keeps us in a dark and confining place. Every one has a door that's locked from the inside. And every one of them is a place that we are more comfortable settling in to. Left to ourselves, we would rather inhabit a prison of our own making than a paradise created by someone else. But we have not been left to ourselves. That is what we've celebrated this weekend. Rather than God turning his back on us, starting over again, what he has done is rescued us and taken us out of the domain of darkness into the domain of light so that we do not have to live entrapped by our sin. And what I want to talk about this morning is the most fundamental, basic, bottom line sin of all, the sin that Ben forgot, the sin of pride. Ben's not the only one who forgets it. Pride has throughout history been conceived of as a high tower. All of these sins in their essence were first noted by the desert fathers as they were out wandering in the desert in about the 3rd century. They were systematized by Thomas Aquinas. And somewhere in the middle of them, Gregory the Great talked about pride as being the most foundational sin. One of the treacheries of pride is that it is so close to home, it's like the air we breathe, that it's very, very difficult for us to see it in ourselves, but it's the one thing we hate to see in each other. And so we look at pride as a tower, and I want to talk about the tower in two ways for a few minutes. The pride as a tower of entitlement, a tower where we look across at God. And then I want to talk about pride as competition, the tower where we look down on each other. So first of all, entitlement. The Tower of Babel starts first to our minds. Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves. It's an ancient sin, and at its roots it has this issue: I will be my own. I will be my own. I don't want a God. I want to be a God. And even for those of us who are Christians, we don't want God on his terms. We want God on our terms. And I want to talk about the Christian struggles with pride here for a moment. I think often we would prefer God to rent the property of our being than to think of him as the owner. I like the idea of God renting space, but not of him owning the whole thing. One of the interesting dialogues that happened in the last century was between the Catholic philosopher Joseph Pieper and C.S. Lewis. And it was actually mostly a monologue. What Pieper, the Catholic philosopher, would do is he would get to a point in many of his writings where he would throw up his hands and say, "Lewis just said it better." And he would just quote Lewis. And here is one of the places where he quotes him. In his wonderful book, The Problem of Pain, C.S. Lewis has tried to visualize man's first sin in paradise. Originally, he says, man's surrender of himself to God required no inner struggle. But then at some point, humans demanded to have something of their own. No doubt they would gladly pay God a reasonable tribute for this privilege of ownership in the form of, say, time, attention, and love. But in the final analysis, it would be their property and not God's. They wanted to own their own souls. But that means to live a lie. Our souls are not our own. The first human beings wanted a vantage point, a private corner of their own in the universe in which they could say to God, "This is our business and not yours." But there is no such corner. Unquote. Here's what I've discovered over the years. My heart has a ton of corners. And just when I think that there aren't any more, Jesus comes tramping into one of them and goes, "What about this one?" And I say, "No, I've given you all of this. Look at all the rental space you have. It's extraordinary what I've given you. You don't really want that, too." And one of the ways to conceive of maturity in the Christian life is the Lord just taking over one corner, and then another corner, and then another corner, until the day where there are no more corners left, and freedom is an extraordinary spacious place. God does not rent us. He is our creator. And he gets to own the house. And pride says no. Not only do I want God to be a renter, but I want God to be an art dealer. Not a potter. I want him to be an art dealer. I want him to market me. I want him to take the things, the gifts that I have, the opportunities that I have, and I want them to be set to their full and complete advantage. And when I do that, I invariably have a very inflated picture of myself. I would submit to you that a great deal of life is wanting God to be our art dealer, not our potter, to market us to our best advantage. And whenever we think this way, we do not think realistically about who we are. We think about who we are in inflated kinds of ways. I remember many, many, many years in my life where I was true, when I was in the depths of my soul, if I was really honest, I did not really believe that God could do more with my life than I could with myself. I really thought that he ought to be my art dealer. We all have our stories. We all have our histories. Here is the 30-second snapshot of mine. I graduated from Bethel College. I got married. I went with my husband to Illinois down here, which I've never been able to seem to escape from. But I stayed here, and I worked with teenage mothers in Youth for Christ for a number of years. And then I decided I wanted to go get my PhD so I could help the church design better programs. I went to Cornell University, which I think is the most gorgeous Ivy League campus there is, got a PhD, and was hired at Wheaton College. In the process, I had a baby, and if you looked at my life, you would have said, "This is a girl that's got everything." And I remember waking up at 35, looking up and going, "Okay, I have accomplished everything I wanted to do with my life. And I'm half through. Now what?" And what I realized was that I had made a really, really stupid assumption. And that was that I could run my life better than God could. And at 35, I decided, all right, I am so empty. I have no other dreams. I have nothing else I want to do. Perhaps I ought to see what happens if I let the potter have my life instead. That was 15 years ago. I will be honest, it has been at one and the same time the most excruciating and the most glorious ride I could imagine. And the one thing I do know is that I'm alive. And the other thing I do know is that God is alive. He is a potter who works with his people and makes us into things that we could not imagine. We don't have creativity or imagination or capacity enough to know what would happen if we let him be our potter rather than our art dealer. But pride says, market me. Jesus had it right when he said this. This is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and people loved the darkness rather than the light because their works were evil. And later in John, he says, I have come into the world as light, so that whoever believes in me may not remain in darkness. It's a dark place to have God as a renter, and it's a dark place to have him as an art dealer. There's a second kind of pride. It's not only the pride of entitlement where we seek to look across the way at God, equals him and me, but it's the kind of pride that's in competition with our neighbor, where we look down at others, where we measure others against ourselves, where we can't just simply do our best. It only is our best if it's better than someone else's. You live in a culture, and I live in a culture, where this is the message we get all the time. Life's about competition. Life's about being better than the next person. I would be very surprised if it doesn't happen at Judson. It happens everywhere. Last week, I was in a situation where someone had the audacity to challenge me in the area that I think is my absolute best work. This is one of the dilemmas of pride. Dorothy Sayers would say, pride is not a sin that gets you where you're weak. Pride is a sin that gets you where you're strong. And last week, when my friend challenged me on the thing that is truly, I think, and I think it's probably accurate, my best creative work, my first reaction was, who do you think you are? And that's where it is so depressing to be writing a series of talks on the seven deadly sins at the same time that you're committing them. And so my second question was, who do I think I am? Who do I think I am? Who gave me these gifts? Why do I think that I should look down on another, or that I ought not be able to receive the critique that comes from another, even in the area of my greatest strength? We compare ourselves with others. We are only good if we are better than someone else. And we tend to boast of qualities we don't possess. We have an inflated understanding of ourselves with others. I'm watching this really interesting phenomenon in my home. I have a 16-year-old son who is addicted to Xbox Live. He has two games he plays, Call of Duty and Halo 3. And I learned a new word in the last 6 months. It's called boosting. It took me a long time to figure out what boosting meant until I would listen to him out of the corner of my ear as he would negotiate with his buddies as to how they were going to play and lose so that he could win, so that he could get more points. And then once he got more points, then he would turn around and do the same thing for them. So he has this artificial score, and right now he's found this buddy that is boosting him to 50 in Halo 3, which I understand is the pinnacle of Halo 3. I'm having a hard time grasping why this is so essential in life, but it truly is to my 16-year-old son. When he has 50, he will have arrived. There's only one problem. If the friend ever leaves him, he's in serious trouble. He will plummet back to the depths of his 30-something that he's at. Pride comes in many shapes and forms. It's shading the truth just a hair. It's making ourselves look just a little better. I remember one time having a meeting where there were 75 people present, and I ran into the dean of my college at that time and told him that there were 100 people present. And as I walked away, it was like something just kicked me in the stomach, and I thought, what was that all about? Why don't I tell the truth? Why do I want to look just a little bit better than I really am? I want to inflate myself. And here's the funny thing about pride, the sin we find so obnoxious in others is the sin that we so rarely are able to see in ourselves. But here is what we will see if we stand in this tower of pride. We will find it is lofty, but it is also very lonely. It's a pretty isolated place to be. And there's only one way out. We sang about it already this morning. Come, let us bow and bend low. The only way out of the tower of pride is to come all the way down to the ground, to live there in such a way that we can look up to God and across to our neighbor. One of my favorite novels is Elizabeth Gudge's Green Dolphin Street. It's an old book. It gets buried on many shelves. It's about two sisters and one guy. It's a great story. At the end of the story, one of the sisters says to the other, "When a humble soul humbles herself, she's not got far to fall. When a proud soul humbles herself, it's like jumping off the top of a cathedral tower." Let me tell you the first cathedral tower I jumped off of. I was teaching at Wheaton. We had a program there. I don't know if you have a program like that at Judson. It's a program where students can take professors out for lunch. So I was being taken out for lunch by one of my male students. Now, when my female students were excited about something, I could sit and lean back and thoroughly enjoy it. When my guys were excited about something, I wanted to just kind of hold on to the end of the table. And this was a hold on to the end of the table moment. And here was why. He had found the Proverbs 31 woman. She was incredible. She had every virtue that any woman could possibly have in the history of the world. And he waxed on and on and on about how glorious this woman was that he was dating, and how she was the Proverbs 31 woman incarnate. And the longer he talked, the more cynical I became. No 21-year-old woman is the Proverbs 31 woman. Frankly, no 50-year-old woman is the Proverbs 31 woman anyway, but that's beside the point. So I sat, I tried to sort of make these sort of statements that sort of tried to bring him down to the ground, but he wasn't coming down to the ground anywhere. He was flying, he was sailing, and that week, as I would go to my devotions afterwards, I would pray, and the Lord would say to me, "You need to apologize to that student." I looked at the Lord and said, "You've got to be kidding. Professors do not apologize to students for stupid things that they are thinking." End of conversation. The next day, "You need to apologize to that student." "I am not apologizing to him. It is embarrassing. I'm not doing it." Okay, this went on for 5 days. The last day, I walk into the room where I pray. I looked at my chair. I burst into tears and went, "All right, then." And I wrote this note. "Dear," I can't remember his name now. "Dear blank, I'm so sorry I was cynical about your Proverbs 31 woman. I bless you with her. May you have a lovely long life. Sincerely, Carla Waterman. And I said, Lord, he is going to be as embarrassed as I am, which was true. He was embarrassed, and I was embarrassed. But you know what happened? I fell off my professor tower. I just fell off it. And it was the best thing that could have happened to me. I was able to just live and laugh and go, you know what, maybe you did find the Proverbs 31 woman. Actually, it was so funny. One of my friends met her 10 years later and went, you know what, he may just have met the Proverbs 31 woman. The door is very low. And what the Lord will continually invite us to do is to fall off our towers. And this is why it is so appropriate to focus on the prison of the deadly sins during Easter week. Because this is a door like all the other doors that is locked from the inside, this prison. And it's a little hobbit door at the bottom. It's one that you got to kneel through. But by Easter Sunday night, Jesus is walking through doors. He doesn't even need us to open them. He just walks right through them. Because sometimes we just need to be rescued. We know we need to be rescued, and we don't know how to unlock the door. And that is no problem to a resurrected Jesus. He comes to a group of disciples who have blown it, who are huddled in fear in a room. And he speaks peace to them, and he breathes on them, and he releases them from their own particular domain of darkness and sends them into his light. And he comes to us the same way. He waits for us to want him, but he will come through our locked doors. And only because he has bent low enough to come in do we have the capacity to bend low enough to come out. And he says to us, come out of your pride. Come out again. Come out again. Come out again. Come out of your dark, cramped tower of self-will and join me in that spacious, light-filled freedom of a kingdom that can only be possessed in humility.